Okay, very good. So let's start the questions again. Okay, see how we go. Let us fire away. Dear Adam, there seems to be a lot of difference between the definition of jhana. I've read Aya Khema's books, and her ideas of jhana seem to be at a different level than the way Ajahn Brahm describes the jhanas. Can you give your thoughts, please? Yes, this is a kind of a common problem with the suttas, is that sometimes there is differences in interpretation. And the way I tend to look at this, there's lots of various kinds of jhana. Sometimes they're called jhana light, and sometimes they're called not jhana light, ordinary jhanas. There's quite a lot of variation here. And sometimes it can be confusing. But one of the things to remember about the jhanas is that they are described by the Buddha to be extremely profound. Yeah, they are almost always on the same level. They're talked about in the same breath as he talks about the awakening experience. They are talked about as the happiness of awakening, talked about as the footprints of the Buddha. When you come to the jhanas, you are literally walking in the footprints of the Buddha. In other words, the Buddha must have been here. This is one of the things that he must have done. Yeah, and so the jhanas are virtually on the same level as awakening. So you can expect them to be extraordinarily profound states. They are not just a state where you are thinking and experiencing a bit of joy or anything like that. They are really otherworldly experiences. They are called, as I mentioned the other day, the end of the world. Yeah, so these are really profound things. So the way I resolve that issue is I usually, the person who explains the jhanas in the most profound way are the most likely person to be right. That's usually how I kind of resolve that. So I feel pretty sure that the way Ajahn Brahm describes it is you can't really go very wrong with that, because the way he teaches jhanas, they are really, really profound. Absolute stillness, complete unification of mind, no movement, no thoughts, no access to the senses, the will is completely gone, and there's all just bliss upon bliss upon bliss for hours on end. And this is what you would expect of these jhana states. So that's how I resolve that. It is very easy to read jhanas into all kinds of experiences, and the reason for that is that the jhanas are often talked about in terms of jhana factors, and those factors, they will be present in the mind even at earlier stages. So the jhana factors are vitakka vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata, unification of mind. Now, if you just take those jhana factors individually like that, a lot of things might fit into that. So what you need to do to understand the jhanas is take the broader context of the suttas into consideration. For example, sound is a thorn to jhana. As soon as you hear a sound, you're no longer in jhana. Yeah, and the sounds, the hearing is usually the last sense to disappear on your way into samadhi. So these are very profound, and I think, the right way of thinking about it. This does not mean that you should despair, because it means I can never attain jhana if they're so profound. Please don't think about that at all. Think about it rather as this extraordinarily interesting journey that you're heading on. And if you're already experiencing a bit of joy and happiness, there is so much more on this path, heading towards the jhanas and heading towards the awakening experience. It rather makes the mystery so much more interesting in many ways, this journey towards all of these positive things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I hope you and Ajahn Akaliko are keeping well. Ajahn Akaliko, there you are. So you are now hereby the teacher. So if you'd like to comment on this, we'll see what happens. Last night you mentioned how a stream enter quickly asks for forgiveness. Would be nice if the rest of us lesser folks could do the same. Okay, you're not lesser, yeah? This is kind of your... Everyone is... I don't like this idea of some being lesser than others. It's just slightly different way of practice, that's all. Sometimes lay people are much better than monks because they're much better, more committed than at many monastics. So they cannot really compare in that sense. How do we move on from the many mistakes made earlier in our lives? We never really forget about them. Thanks, Ajahn. Okay. So, The most important thing is just to learn to forgive yourself. You can ask for forgiveness as well if you want to, and if you feel that helps. You can do that to a fellow Buddhist who you feel you can trust, or you can do it to a monastic, or you can do it in many ways. But the most important thing is that you just learn to forgive yourself. One of the powerful ways that I've been talking about so much throughout this retreat is this idea that we're all so incredibly conditioned. And the more you understand how conditioned you are and other people are, the easier it is to forgive, because you know that actually you didn't really have much choice. It is because it feels like we have choice. It feels like we are deciding to do something bad. That is why you feel responsible, and that is why you can't forgive yourself. But the more you understand that it wasn't so much your choice, that you were conditioned in this way, your upbringing, your past lives or whatever, the more you see that, the more you realize, I did it because I couldn't do anything else. And then it's okay. Yeah, then it's all right. And then you can forgive, and you can let go of the past, and you can move on, and you can be so happy that you're on the right track, moving towards something else, something better. This is really the way to do it. Also, of course, as you do that, you start to appreciate more your good qualities. Because it's obvious that you have lots of good qualities. Because otherwise, you wouldn't even be here if you didn't have many good qualities. Heaps of good qualities. So sometimes you learn to see those good qualities and appreciate that in yourself. We tend to be too self-critical. I think we kind of grow up and we usually get criticized. People usually criticize each other. We don't learn so much about kind of appreciating our good qualities. But actually, especially when you practice this path, there's so much goodness there. Just accept that. Yeah, it's great. It is not natural for people to live well. Sometimes it takes a lot of effort and commitment and perseverance to live a good life. So what a wonderful thing it is that you are here. Practicing meditation, practicing the 8 precepts, trying your very best. It is marvelous. And as you do that, you start to focus on the good qualities, and you forgive the bad ones because you were conditioned into it, and then you are on the highway to letting go of the past. Remember the simile of the salt? The better you live this life, the more diluted the past actions become, the more you forget about them, and the more you leave them behind. By the way, if you wish to ask questions of the bhikkhunis or Venerable or whatever, or please do so as well. It doesn't just have to be me, especially maybe towards the end of the retreat. So it's perfectly okay to ask some extra questions if you have something special you want to ask about or whatever. Okay. In the suttas, you read this arvo. Sanghita Nikaya 46.2, connected discourses. Can you please say again what is meant by the things that are grounds for doubt? Thank you. Also, an awesome topic for a talk series of faults would be the 5 hindrances and 7 bodhangas within the framework of the 4 right efforts. Perhaps an idea for a Friday night talk. Okay, we'll see what happens. The grounds for doubt, it just means that you are focusing things in the wrong way. You're looking at things from a doubtful, from a perspective of kind of that is always doubting things. This can be problematic. There is a basis. You should investigate things properly. But there comes a point when you have investigated it enough and you need to turn more towards the Buddha's teachings. A typical example in the present day would be all the conspiracy theories that you find. Yeah, on the internet, heaps of conspiracy theories about everything. And the more you listen to those conspiracy theories, the more convinced you become that they must be correct. And the reason for that is because there is so much stuff happening in the world, you can find evidence for anything here. Yeah, this is the problem. You can find evidence for pretty much anything here. There's always going to be some gaps in knowledge, some holes, some things going on, regardless of what it is. If someone is looking for evidence for things, they will find it, and they can build up a theory that is really kind of, really contrary to what actually is going on. So this is the problem. So if you keep on looking in the wrong place enough, for long enough, you can doubt anything really. So sometimes you need a more of an overall perspective. You need to have this idea, this look at the Buddha as a person, if he was someone who is trustworthy, if his teachings can be trusted, again, a general acceptance of how the Buddha teaches, and then you provisionally take on board the way he teaches. And as you develop that insight and study of his teachings, you become more and more confident that there must be something right here. Instead of always trying to look at the gaps and the holes and the possible rebirth is just some ancient nonsense or whatever, all that kind of things, it means that you will never get anywhere because you focus too much on the possibilities for there being holes in the theory. If you want to find a hole, you will always find it, but it's not really useful. Look instead at the overall picture, whether it is good or not. So I think it's something like that that is meant. It is how you use these teachings. You have to use them wisely. You have to think in a kind of way which is constructive rather than in destructive ways about these things. Something like that. I'm not sure if that makes full sense, but I think that is part and parcel of what is meant by that. I will put it to one side and I will see if anything comes of the five hindrances and bojangas in the future. Okay. Dear Ajahn, what's the difference between death nimitta and meditation nimitta? Metta and thank you. Death nimitta, it depends what you mean by that. People can have lots of nimittas again. It's just some kind of a vision that you have in your mind, and it's very common for people to have death visions. You die, you may have a feeling that you're going to die, you may have some vision of relatives that have already passed away, they may come and visit you. All kind of things happen around the time you die. So it depends what you mean by that. It's quite a common experience to have all kind of near-death experiences. But if you mean a kind of nimitta that may arise as you pass away, then it is, in other words, like a samadhi nimitta, a kind of light or something like that. Very often it can be the same thing as what you get during meditation practice. So if you are a skilled meditator and you are used to kind of seeing bright lights in a meditation, chances are very good you will see that also when you pass away. Because when you pass away, you are forced to give up. Just like the little meditation we do now, we just did, the idea is just to get a feeling for the idea of letting go. Are you able to really let go? What does it feel like? Not just as an intellectual idea, but feeling that you are in the presence of death and then being forced to let go. What does it feel like? And what it should feel like? It should feel very delightful, because letting go is a very beautiful thing. And that is why death can be, if you're ready, a very beautiful experience of kind of moving away, letting go of so much stuff, all the burdens in life, and feeling the sense of emptiness and metta towards the world instead. So this is ideal, this is the ideal way of death happening. And then the nimitta may arise because of all the positive feelings. And then you move on and you have a wonderful, marvelous experience as you do that. And maybe you even enter a jhana for the first time at that particular point because you're letting go in a very profound way. So many things going on with nimittas when you die, but they are some of the issues. There are some interesting talks about that available. People who are experts who have done a lot of near-death research and talk to people who are dying or had near-death experiences, and a lot of these phenomena you can see that on YouTube videos. Make sure you find some good quality stuff, because some of these researchers are good, other ones are maybe not so good. So make sure you find some good quality stuff. Okay. Ajahn, someone supposedly well-read of Buddhist principles told me that it is all right to gamble, as it is only drawing advance money from the future merits. Okay, I see, right. Okay, is that true? Thank you. Usually what happens, if you try to draw advance money from the merits for the future, usually you end up losing money. It's not a good idea to try to kind of force karma to ripen in the present moment. If you try to force karma to ripen, karma is going to rebel and say, no way, I'm not going to allow myself to be used by you in this way. And then you lose all the money instead. That's what's going to happen. It doesn't work that way. So the Buddha doesn't really recommend gambling. Yeah, if you go to the Sigalovada Sutta and the Digha Nikaya, number 31, 2, 32 maybe, I'm not sure now, 32 I think it is, he says specifically that gambling is often dangerous. I wouldn't really recommend it. I've been gambling a few times and I lost some money gambling, and it wasn't a very pleasant experience. I wouldn't recommend it. And also it can be very addictive, gambling. It can be, once you get into it and you can't stop yourself, and then you waste the entire family fortune, and your children are really upset with you because they don't get any inheritance anymore. In fact, they have to pay for your gambling debts afterwards. Yeah, that's what happens very often. So not a good idea. I would not recommend trying to draw advance money from your merits that you have made for the future. I think that is a wrong way of looking at it. Anyway, so there you are. Sorry? Piyajatika Sutta. Ah, that's right. Yes, okay, that's right. The gamblers, that's right. Yeah, the dodgy character, the duttas. Yeah, they were kind of really got things wrong. Exactly. Majjhima Nikaya 87, I think it is. Piyajatika Sutta. Okay. Dear Ajahn, one, I have worked with some nasty colleagues. I have noticed that a lot of good things happen in their lives. How can this be possible? So, first of all, good things that happen in people's life, you don't really know. What is good? Yeah, I assume that you have a very superficial idea of goodness here. When you say good, maybe you think that they are financially well off or something like that. But if they really are nasty, what you really want to see is their mental state. That is what is interesting here. What happens in this life is very often locked in already. It is locked in from past karma. You've been reborn as a human being. You have certain qualities, and those qualities will tend to lock in how your life proceeds. It takes a lot for things to change in this life. You have to be really, really bad and really stupid to change your entire course of your life. So what is more interesting, if they really are nasty, what you should look at is at their mental happiness. How do they fare mentally? Do they have lots of friends? Are they deeply contented inside? That is what matters. The superficial stuff is so superficial anyway. It doesn't make any difference. If you are discontent because you have lived badly, what's the point of having material success? It's just like icing on a badly made cake. Yeah, the icing is only going to make a tiny bit of difference. The cake is still going to be nasty underneath. Same kind of problem. So it's very hard to judge these things. Yeah, it's very difficult to really know. So it doesn't really mean very much. But what will happen? It is when you go from one life to the next one. That's usually when the big differences happen, because then you have built up, or you have made a mind which is kind of in a nasty state, and that will then obviously affect how we get reborn, because that has an immediate effect. If you are happy and content, you will get reborn accordingly. If you are feeling miserable and down, you will get reborn according to that. So it doesn't really mean anything, the external circumstances. Number two, I still have bad feelings towards them. How can I get rid of these if they are no good qualities in them to focus on? If there are no good qualities to focus on, then you have compassion. Yeah, people who have these things, they are bound to suffer as a consequence, and they are certainly moving towards lots of suffering in the future. Even if they have some temporary success, maybe it looks like they are successful in climbing the corporate hierarchy by doing nasty things to their colleagues. Sometimes these things happen. It doesn't mean anything. For them, it's going to be an empty victory at the end of the day. Maybe they go up the hierarchy. So what? It's empty inside. You have no real happiness. What's the point? Much better to be contented inside and not to climb that corporate hierarchy. Just be content with what you have. Who cares? What difference does it make whether you are at one level or another level? It makes probably no difference at all. After a while, you get fed up with your new level and you want to go even further. Especially if you if your self-esteem and your value is all about how high in the hierarchy you are and not about how you live your life, then chances are you will always crave for more, because you will never find that satisfaction. You are in many ways destroying your life by living like that. So very good grounds for having compassion for people like that, because they are really destroying their own lives. That's what they're doing here. So please have compassion when you see bad things happening in the world. Dear Ajahn, you briefly mentioned about emptiness. What is emptiness? What does it mean for daily life and meditation practice? Mahayana tradition mentions about the Heart Sutra. Does it exist in one sutta? Emptiness is just a synonym for non-self, for anatta. So emptiness just means that when you look inside of your mind, there is nothing there that you can really hold on to as the real core, the real self, because things are always changing. Even consciousness itself is an empty process that is always moving around. And if you try to grasp onto anything in there as the real you, you will always be disappointed. So it's just a synonym for non-self. And in the suttas it says that five khandhas, they are empty of a self, and anything that belongs to a self, atta, attaniya. So that is really all it means, but it's just a particular framework or a particular angle from which to understand the idea of non-self. What does it mean for daily life and meditative practice? Doesn't mean very much for daily life, probably. But what it means for meditation practice, well, it can mean something for daily life. It's a bit like non-self. It just means that people are conditioned to be what they are. So it means you have more metta and more kindness and more compassion for them, because you understand that they are who they are because of cause and conditions, and not because they want to be that way or because they are that is their self, anything like that. Mahayana tradition mentions about the Heart Sutra. Yeah, the Heart Sutra is a short sutra which is similar to the Prajna Paramita Sutra, which is one of the core suttas of Mahayana Buddhism. Does it exist in one sutta? You know, I guess you're asking, does it exist in the Pali tradition or Theravada tradition? No, it does not. It is only a Mahayana sutra. Yes, they have that sutra. It's a contraction of the larger Prajna Paramita Sutra, one of the most popular and important suttas in the Mahayana tradition. I don't know all that much about it, so that's what I can do. Okay. Okay, reflection on kamma. Could you please say a little about this? Especially the phrase kamma bandhu is usually translated as related to kamma, but I don't think kamma is one's aunt or sibling or whatever. Kamma patti sarano comes down as abide in and supported by kamma. Is there a better translation here? Kamma bandhu means something like kamma as a relative. That's basically what it means. Bandhu is a relative. The ancient Brahmins of India, they took Brahma to be their bandhu. They were relative of Brahma, the god Brahma. In Buddhism, you are related to your kamma. And it's not related in the sense of, you know, something external to you. It is more like related in the sense that this is close to you, something that forms you, that affects you in a very powerful way. That, in that sense, you are related to it. So you take it as your something very close to you in your life. Kamma patti sadhano, it means that you take kamma as your refuge. Yeah, abiding and supported by the kamma means it is patti sarano. Sarana is the same word as the ti sarana, the three refuges. And so same word is being used here. It is your refuge in the sense that if you make good kamma, then you have a refuge for the future. You have a security. You have kind of a savings in your bank account that you can draw on later on down the line. In that sense, it is your refuge. If you made bad kamma, then you don't really have a refuge, yeah? Or you have a bad refuge, or whatever you want to call it, because you're going to suffer as a consequence. So one of the other things the Buddha says about kamma, he says that you are the owner of your kamma. So the Buddha often talks about all the things in the world, you are not the owner of them, you're just borrowing all the worldly things, and you have to leave them behind very soon. But there's one thing, only one thing the Buddha says you own, and that is your kamma. And that is because the kamma is the one thing that you take with you past the end of this life, and it carries on into the future, often crossing the boundary of many lives. Ultimately, you don't even own that, because eventually it kind of peters out, but it is much more lasting than the things that belong to this life. So much better to take kamma as your ownership rather than all the very ephemeral things that belong to this particular life. So it's a good way of thinking about it. So what actually is that kamma? That kamma is just the qualities that you build up inside of yourself during this life. Yeah, the more positive qualities you build up, and you can feel it. Yeah, as I said before, you do something good, you feel it inside of yourself, and you build up that more and more and more. So you have a maximum good feelings inside of you. You know, feeling joyful, feeling bright, feeling light, feeling mindful, all of these things that comes from developing the good qualities. And then when you die, your mind is already there. Yeah, you have already those qualities in the mind. So because they are there, you continue on that level. And that is the meaning of a good rebirth in the future. Just like you continue on that level in this life, once you develop good qualities, same way you continue across lives as well. This is how it carries on into the future. The qualities of the mind are fairly stable once you develop them in this way. Okay. And then, if sensual desires are harmful, is it a blessing when someone is born blind, deaf, etc.? I don't think so. Yeah, I think that doesn't really help very much just to be born blind. You're still going to have some desires. You can't be born without all five senses. You're going to have some senses there. Something is going to remain, and the desires will just play out in those senses instead. So if you are blind, okay, you won't crave much for seeing, but the other senses will kind of come in instead. So you can't get out of sensual desire that way. I don't know if you had some cunning plan here or what, but but it's not going to work. The only way to overcome sensual desire is by actually reducing them in this life, by seeing their hollowness and their problem. But it's not that harmful. Yeah, it's important to keep things in context. Ill will is much more harmful than sensual desire. So I would recommend you to focus mostly on ill will. That is far more important. But if you can deal with sensual desire as well, especially if you are a keen meditator, then good. But start out with the ill will. That is the biggest problem. That is the one that really lets you down in the long run. Okay, I'm going to take this one. Dive in. Oh, okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn, when you mentioned about the king of the Nordic gods, my mind went back to suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya named Pahayana, not sure of the name, but the number may be 66 or 67. I think you mean Paharada Sutta, probably. The suttas, as you would know, Ajahn, are about the king of the Asuras. Exactly, that's Paharada, yeah? The Asura, the Titans, making a visit to the Lord Buddha and receiving a Dhamma discourse about the eight qualities of the Saddhamma. Lord Buddha compared the eight qualities of Saddhamma to the eight qualities aspect of the ocean, which is the kingdom of the titans of the Asuras. As I understand, the Nordic people are great seafarers and rely on the ocean. So would you say, Ajahn, that the king of gods and your ancestors visited the real Buddha, received a personal Dhamma discourse from the Lord Buddha, and as a result, he may have this fellow, the king of Asuras, may have been born as a Buddhist in his former land. And then, what would you say? I say that's a very, very interesting story. Who knows? Anything is possible. It sounds like some kind of, I think we should make a movie out of that one. That sounds really, it would be a really good script for a movie, I think. Anything is possible. It's interesting that apparently there was a grave in Norway some years ago. They found a small Buddha statue, and that Buddha statue apparently went back to the Viking age, because the Vikings, they were great seafarers, and they traveled all the way to the Black Sea, all the way to the Middle East, and in the Middle East there would have been Buddhism probably at that time, before Islam kind of started to spread out. At least in certain parts of the Middle East, maybe Persia or something like that, and they must have exchanged something. I don't know what they had, some fish perhaps. I'm not sure what the Vikings had, and they got a Buddha statue in return. So that was found in the Viking kind of in Norway a few years ago. So maybe you had a point. Yeah, you can bring that into your script here, and you can see what you can come up with. Yeah, very, very interesting idea. Maybe we should put that aside as potential movie script for the future. Yeah. Okay, very good. Dear Ajahn, why did Ajahn Janavimala make the aspiration not to stay at a place for long and was always on the road after 10 years of becoming a monk? Is it because of this kind of Tudong practice is advantageous to monastic practice? What are the requirements for being a Tudong monk? Thank you. I think that it depends. I think he probably was just thinking about the suttas at that time. It was fairly common for monks to move around quite a bit. But it is not really one way or the other. There is only one thing that really matters in the practice of a monastic or any Buddhist, and that is whether you are making progress or not. That is the ultimate decider whether you are in the right place or not. So you can stay in the monastery for long periods of time as long as you are making progress. In fact, the Buddha specifically says that if you are in a place where you are making progress, you should stay on. In fact, he says that if you are told to leave by the senior monk, you should say no. I'm staying. That's what he says. It's pretty cool, isn't it? The Buddha gives you lots of kind of special allowances, and you can kind of say, you can kind of just, you know, that's what this idea of chaining yourself to the front gate I was talking about before comes from. Sorry, I'm not going. I'm staying here. It's kind of interesting, and the reason why that is the case is because you are making progress, you are fulfilling the purpose of the monastic life, you should stay. So you have even the right to say no when the senior monk tells you, ask you to leave because he can't stand you anymore or whatever it is. So kind of fascinating. I suspect that he was reacting to some stories in the suttas, maybe the way the Buddha was doing a lot of wandering initially, and maybe he felt that there wasn't any particular monastery where he wanted to stay and could make good progress in. He wanted that independence perhaps, not being attached to anything. One of the things about wandering around all the time is that it means you have to have very few possessions, because you can't wander around everywhere with lots of possessions. And apparently all he had was his robes. He had a little bowl and a tiny little bag with some, I don't know, sewing needles or something like that, and that's all he had, and that is how he lived for 40 years or whatever. So that is kind of one of the advantages. You settle down less, you are less kind of attached maybe to one place or whatever. But it is not really a requirement. It's a very tough kind of practice, and I think it is not for the majority of monastics to live like that, especially as you get older. Maybe you can do it to some extent in your 20s or something, but there comes a point when this kind of becomes unsustainable. Actually, he did it until he was 80 or something. I don't know how he did it. He must have been a very tough character here. So, yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I cannot see how someone can enjoy indolence. Please explain more about this. If you can't understand it, excellent. Yeah, there's nothing more to explain. There's no need to explain anything here. You are on the right track here. If I explain, you might start enjoying dullness. I won't take any risks. Yeah. So it's good. If you can't understand that, it means that you have already the right attitude. So no need to kind of, I think, get into that. As long as you have that attitude, you're okay. It just means that for some reason you enjoy it because, you know, you're suffering too much and it's going to dull out, something like that. Okay, sorry about that. That's a very quick, very short answer here. Dear Ajahn, what is the Sutta Nipata? Why is the Metta Sutta, Mahamangala and Ratana Sutta in the Sutta Nipata and not in the Anguttara? Diga Majjhima Nikaya, like the other suttas, were they added afterwards or recited not by the Buddha? Thank you, Ajahn. Sutta Nipata is a collection of suttas found in a book, and a collection of suttas is called Sutta Nipata. That's really all. Nipata means chapter, something like that, and Sutta means Sutta, the chapter of suttas or something like that. It's a kind of slightly strange name. It is a collection that is unique to Theravada Buddhism, Pali Buddhism. Many of the suttas that are there are also found in other schools, like you find them sometimes in Chinese translation, which often would have been the Sarvastivadin school perhaps or something like that, but not the entire collection, only small parts of it, like the Atthakavagga, Parayanavagga, Ratana Sutta, and a number of other individual suttas. I don't even know all the details of that. Why are they not in the other collections? It's very hard to say. The other collections don't usually have suttas that are entirely in verse. Most of the suttas in the Sutta Nipata are entirely in verse. And for that reason, they probably had a special collection for things that were in verse. Yeah, and maybe they were added a little bit later on. It doesn't mean that it's not original. In fact, a lot of this quite likely is original because some of the suttas actually mention the suttas in the Sutta Nipata. Yeah, they actually talk about them. In some of the suttas on the Anguttara Nikaya, for example, the Buddha is asked about the meaning of certain verses in the Sutta Nipata verses. So obviously they would have existed at around the same time. But for some reason it was separated out and made into a separate collection. Exactly why that is the case, I don't know. You have to remember your past lives and go back to the time of the Buddha and ask them in person and see what they say about that. Okay, so, yes. Okay. Okay, so here we have page number one. 60 robots seeking some fine-tuning from a far more better programmed one. The geeky robot Brahmali over 9 days. Okay, hoping to achieve greater autonomy and learn some self-programming to become happier robots. We met that from Robot in 7C. Okay, I don't know who that is. Someone is in 7C Robot who is enjoying the process very much. Okay, good. If as long as you are enjoying the process, then robothood is quite nice. By the way, you have your job cut out, Ajahn. 60 is a lot of faulty robots. Good thing you are using the clever voice-activated code-tweaking method is much more efficient than rewriting code line by line. Okay, I'll take your word for it. So, good. The problem is that I'm also a robot. Yes, there's a robot kind of programming other robots, and you are probably programming me in return because we're all programming each other, kind of mutual influence. So it gets very complicated after a while. So just enjoy your robot status and see what comes of it. It's not as bad as being a robot as you might think, I suppose. It's a very useful idea. Of course, the idea of being a robot, it never really kind of hits home fully because the sense of self is so strong. So very often you have to use the sense of self to live in the right way. But sometimes the idea of a robot can be very useful, especially when it is about forgiving yourself and forgiving others, because understanding conditionality is really what it is about. Anyway, dear Ajahn, can you please elaborate more on the metta aspect you mentioned today in your afternoon talk? Thank you. That was about the subha nimitta, I think you're probably referring to. Subha means, in Pali, means beautiful. Things are beautiful or ugly. Asubha is the non-beautiful. It is the things that you do in meditation when you focus on the 31 parts of the body or the cemetery contemplations. You focus on the non-beautiful or the ugly or even sometimes repulsive when you think about some of those cemetery contemplations. Even quite repulsive sometimes. So the idea of metta is to focus on the beautiful aspects in other beings, seeing the good qualities. Ill will is the exact opposite. That's when you focus on the faults and the negative things, and it gives rise to anger as a consequence. So metta is seeing the beautiful in other people. And there's a lot to be seen. Yeah, we have a tendency to focus on people's faults, but there's a lot of good qualities to be seen in other people as long as we stay with that and we persevere in trying to see those things. It's just a matter of refocusing a little bit. Very often what we see are the small little mistakes people do, and we forget how the overall life of people often is heading in a good direction. And people are generally doing a lot of good in their lives, supporting each other, doing many, many positive things. So that is the subha aspect, seeing the beautiful. And especially when you start to see the mental states of people who live well, mental states of generosity and kindness, and you start to appreciate those mental faculties. And of course, that is very, very, very lot of beauty to be focused on in that area. And there comes a point, and this is, I think, the idea of the focusing on the beautiful here. It talks about a particular kind of liberation of mind. And that liberation of mind comes when you take that focus on the beautiful to its highest limit. And you kind of blot out any possibility of seeing negative things because you're focusing 100% on the positive in other people. And of course, that has very beneficial consequences for your own meditation practice. And this gives you a lot of the idea, the hint on how to do metta practice. I mentioned a number of suttas the other day about things that you can focus on. Look at how to develop metta, and the Buddha very often starts out by talking about developing metta in by body and speech, first of all, just being kind to the people around you, thinking of your speech as a gift to the people around you in the world. It's a wonderful way of thinking about speech. Just being kind through speech and through your bodily activities. And then you can also think about it in terms of your mental, how you think about other people. I'm not talking about meditation, just in general how you think about people in ordinary life, and try even to think about people with metta. Sometimes it may not work, sometimes you may have to use compassion, but either compassion or metta will always work. And then when you create this foundation, and this foundation can take a long time to create, you just have to keep on at it, becomes very strong, then eventually you can sit down and you can start to have this metta meditation that we tried to do the other night, the other evening. We start to be much more effective because you can truly mean to be kind to other people. You actually really want to wish other people well because you see the good qualities. You have certain perceptions in your mind. You see the goodness in other people, and it really comes from your heart when you wish them well. And that's when it becomes very powerful, and it starts to happen. Eventually developing into the subha nimitta, or the subha adimutto, when you are focused on the beautiful. Okay. Did I mention a sutta at that point? I think the idea of subha atimutta, I think it is one of the eight vimokas. So I think if you go to one of the sutras that has one of the eight vimokas in it, I think the third vimoka or something like that is the Subba Adimutta, I think. Yeah. It's not actually talked a lot about. It's kind of just one of those things that are there. So sometimes you have to draw things together from different sources and make something out of it. Yeah. Can you remember sutta mentioned in sutra? No? Yeah? Hmm. Oh, that has in it. Okay, which one is that again? No. Okay, 4654. Okay, so that is one of the places you can go to. So, Bhojanga Sanyutta, which is the 46th Sanyutta in the Connected Discourses, Sutta number 54. Yeah, check it out. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay, Ajahn, was Pali a spoken language? What is the difference between Pali and Sanskrit? Thank you. Was Pali a spoken language? There is some disagreements with scholars about that, whether it was spoken or not. The usual standard understanding is that Pali is may have been spoken, but probably some time after the Buddha. If you look at inscriptions that have been found in India over the last area of India, in say around the 2nd century, 1st century BC, they have a language that is very similar to Pali. So it seems to have been a language that existed in South India or Central India, not in the Northwest because that was different, for at that particular time. That's why it was then probably transmitted to Sri Lanka, because obviously the south of India or central India would have been where the suttas came from when they were transmitted to Sri Lanka. But the difference between this particular language and the language spoken by the Buddha would have been very small. It wouldn't have been much difference. So in some sense you could possibly say that the Buddha spoke Pali. It's a bit like the English language. If you look at the English language, it has changed so enormously over the centuries. And if you look at English that was spoken, say, in the 14th century or something like that, Chaucer or something like that, it is actually sometimes it can be hard to read because the language has changed so much. Even Shakespeare, it sounds quite archaic when you read Shakespeare. And that is only, 400 years ago, or a bit more than that. But it's still called English, and in the same way I think it is fair to call what the Buddha said, it is so close to this language, it is not wrong to call it Pali. Some people said the Buddha spoke Magadhi because that was kind of the language of the Magadhan Empire which arose after the Buddha, but that doesn't seem quite right either, because the Buddha wasn't born in Magadha, he was born further north. Basically, the languages in that era were very similar to each other. They were all Indian languages, maybe with slightly dialectical differences because of the areas. But essentially, you can say it was pretty much Pali. Whether Pali was ever truly spoken, or only something similar to Pali was spoken, still being debated by scholars, there may not be a final answer to that. But for all practical purposes, you can say it was spoken. What is the difference between Pali and Sanskrit? Sanskrit is like the hegemonic language of ancient India, the language that was kind of the important language of the educated classes, the Brahmanical caste. They spoke Sanskrit. The ancient Vedas were written in Sanskrit, and Sanskrit became... First of all, there was what is called classical Sanskrit, and then there is the kind of really ancient Sanskrit. And classical Sanskrit is a type of Sanskrit that was formalized by a grammarian in India called Panini. And Panini, he kind of laid down all the rules for Sanskrit, so it became like a fixed language in India. And that is the same Sanskrit that is being used officially today, if people write in Sanskrit. It's very similar to Pali, lots of similarities, but the grammar is quite a bit more complicated in Sanskrit than it is in Pali. Pali is easier to learn, Sanskrit is the official language of the Brahmanical caste and the official literary language of India, whereas Pali would be one of the vernaculars, one of the spoken languages called Prakrit. Prakrit are the natural languages. Sanskrit is the created artificial language used for the Brahmanical scriptures. That is really the difference between the two. And Pali was one of those Prakrit languages. Something like that. Okay. And of course, at the later stage, even Buddhist texts were translated into Sanskrit, because Sanskrit was a very prestigious language in ancient India, so some of the Buddhists wanted their scriptures to be more prestigious, so translated into Sanskrit. Whether that was a good idea, not sure. Prestige can sometimes be a bad thing, but that is what they did. Devante, technical question. Does the rise and fall of the aggregates, khandas, form a moment of consciousness? Please correct me here. The idea of moments of consciousness is really an Abhidhamma idea. It does not really exist in the suttas in quite that way. In the suttas, you focus on things coming into existence and then staying for a while. This is how it is mentioned in the suttas. They arise and then they stay and they change while they stay and then they cease. So in the suttas, there is a much more extensive lifespan over the things that we experience. A feeling can last for a while, a perception, all these things can last for a while, arising, changing, and eventually ceasing. In the Abhidhamma, this is formalized into moments. Everything just comes into existence and then disappears again. And there's no real room for changing while it is in existence. So this idea of momentary consciousness is really a later development when they try to make a philosophy out of Buddhism and they try to pin down everything with absolute accuracy. And sometimes things get lost when you do that. I prefer the terminology used in the suttas of things often said to last over a long period of time. For example, the Buddha talks about the physical body. And when he talks about the physical body, he says, well, it lasts for 80 years, yeah, it is there all the time. It is kind of has a lasting, the mind changes all the time, but the physical body lasts over a long period of time. So this is more how the Buddha talks about things, and it is more natural in a sense, whereas the Abhidhamma tries to kind of draw out some ultimate principles for these things. That's how the Abhidhamma works. So it's best not to think in terms of moments, think in terms of change instead, arising, changing, and then ceasing. And that is what the rise and fall of the, not really rise and fall, more like the arising and disappearing. Rise and fall gives the feeling of something that might always be there, but it kind of goes up and down like a wave. But this is arising from nothing, disappearing into nothing. There's a different kind of idea about what is going on now. Okay. Dear Ajahn Bhamali, though your prediction of only going downhill seemed to imply I would succumb to the will instead of exclaiming Sabbang Aditang, still I say Aho Sukhang. Still the best retreat ever. Okay. Very good. Huh? Instead of exclaiming Sabbang Aditang, everything is on fire, is Sabbang Aditang. Still I say Aho Sukhang, oh what happiness. Good, I'm very glad that you say that, that's really nice. Just wondering if you can fit in at the end of a Q&A session, please read us the Upaklesa Sutta, the part where the Buddha says better it is to walk alone at ease like a tusker in the woods. Thank you so much for your wisdom and Veda. I'm looking forward to the Potamia Sutta tomorrow. Okay, that's very good. I will see if I can find, if I can read out those little verses. They are indeed very nice, very beautiful little verses. I'll see if I can get those out and we can maybe have a look at them tomorrow. I haven't got anything with me here and I can't remember them off the top of my head, so I'm going to have to find them. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how can one be born in the Deva realm? Okay, is that your plan, to be reborn in the Deva realm? Are you sure that's a good idea? You can try that as a temporary stopgap measure, but then you have to go beyond later on. Yeah, that's kind of the idea. So what is required for being reborn in the Deva realm? And what is required is you have to just live well. You have to be kinder. You have to be compassionate. You have to do all the right things. You have to avoid the bad things. And as you do that, then eventually you build up enough good qualities inside of you. You get reborn in the Deva. But you have to be a little Deva right here in this life. Can you be a little Deva in this life? Sometimes when I sit outside and I have the interviews in the afternoon, the Devas come and give me tea. It's nice, isn't it? Yeah. So we have little Devas on this retreat. So you have to be one of those little Devas and kind of help out like that. So just do Deva things. Yeah. When you do Deva things, you become a little Deva, and then you get reborn in the Deva Loka. You have to feel like a Deva. When you feel like a Deva, you move on to the Deva Loka afterwards. What does it feel like to be Deva? It feels to be kind, to be light-hearted, yeah, to enjoy yourself and all these kind of things. That's kind of what Deva is like. Yeah. So live really well, then you're on the right track. Yeah. How many realms of existence are there? Ooh, many realms of existence. You traditionally said to be 31 or 32 or something like that. It is not something to be too concerned about. This is like a traditional number. The main point is that there are a lot of different, you get reborn according to your karma. So whatever your karma is like, that is roughly how you get reborn. And there really are, in one sense, as many realms as there is different types of karma. Within the human realm, you could always subdivide the human realm if you wanted into different karmas, because people are so different. And in the same way, there's just you could really subdivide the heavenly realm in many, many different ways, presumably. But there is a traditional way of doing it. And perhaps, I don't know how seriously that is to be taken, how fixed it is. Probably not all that fixed. Probably things always moving and changing around a little bit. So the traditional number is 31 or 32, but I wouldn't worry too much about those numbers. They're not really all that significant. Also, you mentioned the animal realm is the lower or worse than the ghost realm. Why is that? I see animals sometimes behaving better than humans. yes. Why is it? Why it is true? Because animals are kind of stuck. Yeah, they can only behave in a certain way because they are so heavily conditioned. Human beings, they have more freedom, and sometimes they abuse that freedom that they have, and they behave really badly. And you kind of your animals, they seem really kind compared to those humans. So there's some truth to that because of the limits of being an animal. That's not really the point. It's not how animals behave. It is what karma brought them to the animal realm. That is what matters. Remember, the animal realm is incredibly diverse. So there may be some animals that are quite happy. Yeah, maybe you get reborn in a nice family as a cat or a dog, and you get pampered like some humans don't even get pampered that way. Some of these pets. Or you can get reborn as a mosquito. Yeah, or a worm in the ground, or a maggot in a corpse. There's lots of rebirth in the animal realm that is really, really bad and really terrible. So when we talk about the animal realm, the vast majority of animals, they are mosquitoes, they are worms, they are flies, they are that kind of thing. And that is where, when we talk about the animal realm, that we really talk about. The ghost realm, the reason why it is not as bad as the animal realm is simply that there is less suffering. The animal realm is considered to be more suffering. Yeah, especially all those low animals, really bad lives, short, nasty, brutish. The big animals eat the small ones. You always have a lot of fear, lots of problems. It is a very harsh life. So it just means that ghosts have less suffering than animals. Yeah, it's better to be reborn as a ghost. And actually, this is specifically mentioned in the suttas because they kind of give you the hierarchies, and the ghost realm is always above the animal realm. Animal realm and hell realms are supposed to be the worst ones, because then there is no actions that you can do to really get out of there. You just have to wait for your karma to ripen, and then when your karma is finished, bang, you come back again to the human realm or something, and then as soon as you come back to the human realm, because you are silly, you do all those bad actions again and straight back to the animal realm. It's terrible, isn't it? That's actually what it says in one of the suttas, because once you have that lack of wisdom, you become silly and you kind of keep on staying in that realm. Gee, that is really bad news. Is there a hell realm? That's what it says in the suttas. According to the Buddha, there are realms where you suffer enormously. They are called hell realms. So if you do really bad things, lots of really bad things, then you can get reborn in these realms. Very often because you feel you deserve it. You come to the end of your life, you feel really, really bad about yourself. Actually, why did I do all of those things? That was a really bad idea. And then you send yourself off to the hell realms as a consequence. So it seems that there may be such realms where you suffer enormously because you have lived a really, really bad life. So, okay. Okay, hearing ill will as resistance was a bit of a light bulb moment for me. I'm so grateful that we have a wonderful teacher like yourself who keeps the Buddha's teachings alive. Thank you. Yay! Okay, good. I'm very glad that you are getting something out of it, because people are always different. You never know exactly what people will enjoy. So it's great. It's always nice as a teacher to feel that you reach some people. If you don't reach anyone, at least I'm teaching myself. So I can't lose. Yeah, this is a win-win proposition from my point of view. So that is an extra bonus that people are enjoying it, of course. That's great. Dear Ajahn, suppose there are three types of insights: the small insight, the deep insight, and the penetrating insight that uproot the kilesa, the fetters. My question is, if a person gains full enlightenment by wisdom through stages of enlightenment, how many penetrating insights will he experience? From my understanding, it would be three penetrating insights that he experienced: Sotapanna, Anagama, Arahat. Please explain. Thank you. Okay. Insights come in various degrees and levels. And these particular insights that you mentioned here, Sotapanna, Anagami, Arahat, you could maybe add Sakadagami, the once returner, if you wanted to. They are, as you say, really powerful insights, because you are eliminating some of the fetters, some of the defilements of the mind are fully kind of abandoned as you do this. But there are all kinds of other insights available on the path. This is one example of insight. Other insights is, you know, the recollection of past lives, for example, is also an insight. Why is it an insight? Because it opens up a reality for you that is completely different from anything you have seen before. Even if you believe in rebirth, believing is not the same as knowing. Believing is just, okay, you take it on board because the Buddha said so, you have some personal experience or whatever it is. But that is weak compared to actually seeing it for yourself. When you see it for yourself, that is really a kind of wow moment, when you start to understand what this is all about, what samsaric existence is. And that is why it is explained as this idea of the chick breaking out of the egg, seeing reality for the first time fully. So these are also insights. Insights can really, depending on how we measure these things, they come in all kind of quantities and degrees. And sometimes you can get small, very small insights in daily life, and suddenly you understand something, the light bulb moment, bang, the light bulb goes on. That's what they have in the comics, the light bulb lights up, and you have understood something. That can be small insights like that are quite common. Yeah, they can happen at almost any time. And then there can be small insights that happen in meditation practice, when you suddenly drop into a deeper state of samadhi and you see what letting go can do, and you understand what that new state is compared to what you had before. You get an insight, direct insight into suffering and happiness, because suddenly you have realized a deeper state of happiness than you ever had before. And that's also insight. Insight comes together with the samatha, the deepening of the path. So these are all just various kind of insights. So you're right, the four that you talk about here, these are really big insights, very powerful ones, or the three or four you talk about, but they come in a large number of varieties. So it's just a matter of definition, really, where we place the word insight and how we define it, potentially there is a lot of possibilities. Okay, two more questions for tonight. Dear Ajahn Mamali, could you kindly revisit the faculty of faith applied to the Buddha? In other words, please explain the meaning of the simpler word, the blessed one is fully awakened, accomplished, holy teacher of gods and humans. This question may have come in before I explained it, is that right? Because now I think I went through that in a fair bit of detail. So I hope you're happy with that. If not, please come back with that question again tomorrow and we can take it then. Dear Ajahn, I feel so inspired by your Dhamma Dana and all the work you must have done in many ways to be able to give it. I've begun, thanks to you, to stop fearing my hindrances and to instead have an attitude of seeking to make peace with and understand them. Thanks to you, I feel closer to the Buddha, and thanks to you, I have gone from struggling with the restraint of the five senses to loving it. Okay? I thought we were silent to promote mindfulness by the body, but I find instead a joy arising through sense restraint and staying within my own space. That's wonderful. I'm grateful to everyone for the silence and for their practice and their good vibes. I'm grateful for the extra restraint of being free to not look anyone in the eyes. It's funny how strongly my sense of self asserts itself when my eye contacts those of others. Yes, because that's when you become self-conscious, you become conscious of who you are, yes, as soon as you you look at someone else, that's what happens, so quite right. Thank you all for your beautiful hearts and intentions. Please forgive my intentional and unintentional harm I may have caused. Anumodana. Okay, that's a very beautiful note, so that's very nice. So someone who really enjoys the retreat. What a wonderful thing that is. That's a nice note to finish off the evening on. So that's it for tonight. Again, please have a nice rest this evening, and we'll see you back again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.